Welcome to the show. On today's episode, we have Roxana Karimi. She is a licensed marriage and family therapist. She completed her master's in clinical psychology at Pepperdine University. She worked as a therapist in community mental health programs, running groups, and doing individual and family therapy at a residential eating disorder facility. Following her degree, she started working at a nonprofit agency specializing in work with children and adolescents struggling with trauma symptoms due to emotional, physical, or sexual abuse. She is certified in trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy. In today's podcast, we'll be discussing what parentification is, trauma, PTSD, and how it impacts us as children and adults. This is a great episode. Please enjoy. Welcome to the Kat Katibi Podcast, your source for all things health, happiness, and beauty. Hi, Roxana. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Hi, Kat. I'm excited to be here. Thank you.
Today, we're going to be talking about parentification. That's going to be so much fun. But before we begin, could you tell us a little bit about your journey in the mental health field, your qualifications, your specialties, everything about you?
Sure, that sounds great. So I'm a licensed psychotherapist, licensed marriage and family therapist, and I've been in the mental health field since 2010, I think. I got started with working as a mental health worker in eating disorder clinics. I was struggling before that with my own eating disorder and I found help. And so that's what started me on this path toward getting my licensure, was having a therapist that really helped me. And I just kind of continued to pursue that. And now I get to help others.
I know there are different types of parentification, but could you broadly define what parentification is?
Yes. So parentification is like a series of role reversals that the child begins to take on the role of the caregiver in the relationship. So that could be emotionally being there for their needs, maybe on a gender role basis, being there for them if there's different situations happening in the home where the parent's not available. And there could also be what's known as instrumental parentification, which is where the parent is putting not developmentally appropriate responsibilities onto the child. So that's the kid who maybe grew up in a home where mom was severely mentally ill or disabled, and they're taking care of siblings, cleaning, cooking, that kind of a thing.
When I think of emotional parentification, I always think of it like when the parent tells her son they're the man of the house because the father is gone, either divorced or passed away. And the mother also unloads emotional and financial problems on the child. Would that be correct?
Absolutely.
And then for instrumental, I think of that show, Shameless. Have you seen that show?
Definitely. Exactly.
Yes. Yeah. And so the parent's on drugs. Yes.
Yeah. Definitely. And it can just be the parent who is unintentionally putting that responsibility. It doesn't always come from like a super drug use way. It could be the parent who's too busy and now is, okay, you're at this age, maybe you can cook your own breakfast, but necessarily they can't.
So what do you think is the perfect age to start teaching kids to cook breakfast?
I know. I think that's a different one. And it really, it's the energy in which you do that with. So if it's a responsibility for them to be making breakfast for the entire family, that's probably too young up until way later, I would think. Okay. But if that's something that you're doing together as a family, or you're teaching them, it's a responsibility they enjoy, that can be a little bit different.
Okay. So that makes more sense, because I'm trying to think, like, because it sounds like if you tell your kid to do anything, it could be parentification. Go clean your room. That's not my job. I don't want to do that. I'm a kid. I want to have fun.
No. So it would be based on what it is for that parent's need as well. So like you were saying before, the parent who's, you're the man of the house because dad's not there anymore. That's not an appropriate responsibility to place on a child.
And for the emotional stuff too, what happens to a child? Like when you're told like the financial struggles and you have to take on that worry, what can happen?
It creates a lot of undue stress and responsibility for something that they have no control over. There's not anything they can do. And that might also lead them to feel, okay, my parent is in stress, right? And children really need their parents to be super secure and able to care for them to continue to live. So they begin to have worry about their parent being worried too. And this can show up later in adulthood as not having a lot of emotional boundaries with people, really feeling that codependency and people-pleasing behavior, or becoming really self-reliant and hyper-independent because that responsibility feels too heavy.
So let's go more into some risk factors. Sure. So when I was researching, we already went over like divorce, death of a parent. Immigrant parents was one that I know a lot of immigrant parents, and that made me think of, oh my gosh, like maybe, but then I see they're so successful. So I'm like, I don't know. And then it was disabled parent or the siblings disabled, mental health, substance abuse, and financial hardship. So is that like everybody in poverty?
I think everybody in poverty is at risk of emotional parentification. Absolutely. And definitely with immigrant families as well. I come from an immigrant family background and I feel that. But more importantly, these are what I call like inner child wounds. And they happen to all of us because the childhood patterning that we observe and witness really leads to our development and how we feel within ourselves and about the world. And so that's why at those younger ages, if this sort of a codependent relationship is formed with a parent and a child, no matter what the reason for the development of that is, it's going to have an impact.
Yeah, because I'm thinking about especially the immigrant parents, when the immigrant parent doesn't speak the language and they have to rely on the child for every little detail.
Yeah.
That's super stressful, I would imagine.
Definitely. That's like it's a survival, and that survival responsibility being on a child is not going to feel very good, too heavy.
So how prevalent would you say parentification is in the US?
I would say it's pretty prevalent. I think that a lot of different dynamics that you see happening now have developed from this in one way or another. And then obviously this can be on a spectrum too. So I think everybody has experienced pieces of it.
How can a parent that has all these or a few of these risk factors that maybe they're beyond their control, like they're an immigrant, avoid causing parentification on their child or children?
Yeah. And I think the number one step is the awareness, is like recognizing this is something that can happen and develop in your relationship. And then the second most important thing is that parent being able to care for themselves and their basic needs, like getting their own nervous system and their own health to a place of security and well-being to the best that they can. And sometimes that might mean like finding different help and resources to bring into your life to make that easier. And I know that's not always easy or accessible, right? So just again, bringing that to the awareness and knowing what you can best do. So that parent who feels that child should be the responsible one route, right? Like they're really needing support. If they had someone that they're able to talk to about the fear and the anxiety that they're feeling, they wouldn't place that on the kid.
Let's do an example. Let's say you don't speak the language and you need someone to help you grocery shopping or ask a question or something. Is there a way you can get your kid to help you without putting too much responsibility on them? Or it's just you need to find an adult?
It would be best to find an adult, but of course you can't always do that. And so I think also just being able to be clear with your kid about what you're doing and having that be a part of the process too, right? Like, I know this is probably a big responsibility. I really appreciate it. And if you need anything, let me know. Just being able to be open and communicative is going to make a big difference.
I'm an elder millennial, and I know a lot of elder millennials and Gen X or whatever adults. And we talk about when we're together how the majority of us were latchkey kids. Both of our parents were working. Nobody's in the home. We walked or took the bus to and from school. We made our own dinner. We did our homework without being told. Nobody checked it. We went to bed. We got ready. We woke ourselves up. Would that be parentification? Did an entire generation do that?
The latchkey kids. It's true. Yeah. I think about that. I think there could be parts of it present that if a parent isn't physically present, there's going to be some needs that aren't being met for that child at the same time. But not every situation is going to lead to a wound around the emotional parentification that occurs. So it depends, right? Like, how old was that child? And did they feel like they were mature and responsible enough to care for themselves? That would make a big difference.
Yeah, because I remember like all of us, all of my friends, and we would just go play outside with no parents because they were all working. walk ourselves home, yeah. elementary school, middle school, high school, forget it. But yeah. it was a lot of fun. So I don't know. I feel bad for the kids now that don't have that, to be honest. I'm just like, we had a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah. I can see how that could be fun too. And I think it does depend on the child's age and developmental stage too. Like some children are more responsible and they could walk to and from school if they're within like a close distance, that would be okay. And it might not be even for that same distance okay for another kid.
Yeah, definitely. I studied psychology. When I was working with at-risk kids, mm-hmm. I would see like the very young ones. They seemed so much more mature than mm-hmm. like my daughter and her friends. Now they just seem like infants. And I'm just like, how is this four-year-old talking like a grown man and behaving so well? And then the kids that have like more benefits, they seem more childish to me.
They don't have to worry about that. Yes. basic needs as much.
Yes.
Yeah. Trauma can bring a sense of maturity to you, a loss of that innocence and joy in childhood.
So you would say that's not a good thing.
I think that we're so resilient. There's definitely great qualities that are built from that. But I think that when that quality shows up in you, it means it was going to be in you anyway. And it would be great if it didn't have to happen with trauma first.
Are there any of the parenting styles that are more likely to occur with parentification?
Yeah, I would think the parenting styles that are more authoritarian and because I said so type of relationships and dynamics are going to lead with more wounds and mistrust that's built. So really just being open and communicative. And that doesn't mean you don't have to be clear or direct and stick to your boundaries too, but doing it in that kind of a way is going to help build a better relationship.
So without any therapy, do you think that a child who experienced parentification could end up as an overbearing, overprotective parent? Or do you think that they would go the other way and just repeat the cycle with their own children?
It could go either way. Definitely. A lot of times we repeat that cycle, but sometimes we repeat that cycle by trying to go the other way. So it really can go in so many directions, but there will be that subconscious observation. If that's what you witnessed in childhood, that is going to be what you're doing later in life.
Yes. And it's another thing that I witness with the older millennials and Gen X parents is when they have their kids, since they were allowed to do whatever they wanted, whenever they wanted, they are like so on top of their kids that I'm just like, whoa, give them a break to breathe. And everything is so structured. Like we didn't have any structure and they give their kids so much structure that these poor kids, they don't have like time to breathe after school. They're going through different activity after activity.
That's too much. Absolutely. That's sometimes when we go through an experience, we like overcorrect. So this person is, I'm not going to do it like my mom. I'm going to do it differently. But they're having the same result. It's super important for kids to be bored sometimes and for everybody to be bored sometimes, because that's when creativity can really come through in us in whatever action that may result in.
Yes. And I did enjoy, because I was also an only child, so I did enjoy being alone. And I love being alone. I don't understand how anyone could get bored being alone. It's the funnest thing to be alone. Okay, this is just my observation. Tell me if I'm wrong. Okay. But when the parents are more overprotective, I feel the kids, they get bored more easily because they don't know what it's like to not have something going on.
Absolutely. I have clients right now that I'm seeing who they can't even rest. If they have any type of an inclination of I'm just being lazy, they go into anxiety mode. They have to be productive all the time. And so we've been exploring that. And it goes back to anytime we would just be hanging out, my mom would get really upset. She'd make us clean something or do something. Like we could not just sit still.
Yeah, I see that. Oh my gosh. Like my mom's visiting now. And the one thing that she does that makes me so upset is she does not let us sleep. Like as soon as the sun goes up, she's like, let's go, let's start the day. And I'm like, oh no, this is horrible. And my husband's, oh gosh.
She wants everyone to wake up with her.
Yes. And she's, you have to be protective. Don't be lazy. Don't be lazy.
Oh no.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Oh, more moving from parentification to just parenting in general. What are some healthy examples of ways a parent can discipline or create resilience and emotional stability in their child?
That's a great question. I think the more that you communicate and are open about emotions too, like really being in dialogue about that with your kids and reflecting it back and allowing them to do activities that build their self-trust. So do give developmentally appropriate responsibilities to the child so that they can feel that success too and know, okay, I can do it. And that helps build that reliance in them.
The reason why I really wanted you to come on was because I did another podcast and I had someone, we mentioned parentification in the context of single mothers and how it's so prevalent when you're a single mother to get the emotional support from your child. And it's a bit inappropriate, but for single mothers in general, because I just feel like I think it's going to be like almost all mothers soon because it's just so prevalent in society. People are just not getting married anymore. Divorce rates are a much higher. People just rather co-parent than get married or whatever. Guys don't want to cohabitate because of the laws anymore. I don't know. There's a whole lot of fear going around with marriage. So if you end up or are a single mother, what are some things that they need to consider when parenting their children?
Number one thing would be get into some sort of therapy, get into some sort of self-reflection with yourself and receive support so that you're taken care of.
And is there things that they should not do that might be common?
Yeah, I think what can really happen in that situation for a single parent is they feel like there's a lot of fear, there's a lot of stress. It's a really impossible job, honestly, for one person. And they also don't want to leave their child. They want to spend time with their child. And so this kind of develops this codependent bond. They're not ready to necessarily move on and find a new partner or leave their child with a babysitter to go out with friends. That doesn't feel good. I get that too. But the more that this parent can fill their other needs first, they won't be placing that responsibility on their child and then having it come from a place of guilt, which can really build resentment as well. So I've got this kid with me and of course I love them, but the rest of my life is over. That's not going to be the best thing that you can do. Giving your love, attention, and time fully to the child and expecting that back is just not right.
Are there any unrealistic expectations that parents have of their children?
To fulfill their own needs, to follow in their same path. I think that's something immigrant families really experience too, especially when it's like, oh, we came here for the American dream and that's this one little version. So now you're living through that and thinking that's what I should do too. And we all experience that, the programming that we grew up with, the conditioning that we received. And then you do get to a point where these symptoms get to be too much and you start doing your healing work and you can be free of the programming and really align with who you are. It's a joy at the end, but there's a lot of unlearning that comes from the different pains that we pick up.
So do you ever work with clients on relationships?
Definitely. I would say that's the number one thing that we work on, relationship to self and others.
Have you noticed when you're working with people that there's a newer fear of marriage, commitment?
I wouldn't say that I'm seeing a newer fear, but what I'm seeing is like a, what is the point of this anymore thing? And especially as the identity around marriage and relationships is changing, there's a lot of polyamorous couples. Obviously, there's different gendered couples, same-sex couples, throuples. So it all just is changing. And I think there's a shuffling that happens.
Are you noticing any type of combination that seems to be doing better than others?
I haven't noticed that necessarily, no.
I also wanted to know about the waiting until you're older to have children.
Yes.
Has that been an issue?
I think it's been an issue because there's just a lot of responsibility, I think, that women feel and wanting to prove yourself and be that woman who has it all right. There was all these things that we were told was the great thing to do too. Get the education, but also get the man and you can do that later. You got to get the career first. So a lot of people have been striving for that. And I don't think there's anything wrong with it by any means, but now we're seeing like the population is also dipping. People aren't having children or you get into that later age and you don't want to. And I think it's a personal choice at the end of the day, but it's interesting to see those societal changes happen.
Because I saw some statistic, I think it was like 44% of women are going to end up single mothers. That's crazy.
Wow. That does seem pretty high.
So I'm just like wondering what is going on. Why do people hate marriage so much?
I think just our idea of marriage might be changing. And so anytime that's happening, we're going to project all of our fears onto whatever that thing is as well. And so maybe that's where it's coming out is, I don't know what this means anymore.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about what trauma-focused behavioral cognitive therapy is. Could you give us some examples compared to what we think of as traditional psychotherapy?
Yeah. So traditional psychotherapy is going to have that more psychodynamic and like attachment based view to it. So you're exploring those childhood relationships and seeing where the impact is. For trauma focused behavioral, cognitive behavioral therapy, it's a little bit more of a laser focused. It's an evidence based practice that walks you through the trauma experience through different aspects so that you're like receiving desensitization through it, you're processing, you're creating your narrative around the story and the experience that you had. And yeah, so it's just a little bit more of a solution focused effect of that. And then once you do that, you can really do the processing work around how is that showing up for me.
I remember when I was in school and I took a class on cognitive behavioral therapy, my professor said, this is the only part of psychology that is evidence-based. This is the real psychology. And I just thought that was so funny that not a lot of people go into that specific niche.
I think that it's a really great niche for sure too, because there's so much to our thoughts that is so important, and definitely for the subconscious rewiring that you do, the reprogramming of your mind. That's what cognitive behavioral therapy really is and started as its core, is being able to change the thoughts to feel better. And that's really important when it comes to trauma as well too, because it's developing a story around what happened to you and also the impacts of that and the side effects of that. So being able to really shift your entire perspective can create so much change within you. Mentally, physically, at the spiritual level, really different.
Do you find that people who go through a cognitive behavioral therapy for maybe a trauma or something, that afterwards they can end up healthier and maybe like pains go away?
100%. So much trauma comes out in the physical symptoms and in the body. And as you heal that, you will find improvement there too.
Yeah, I've heard about this and I thought that was super cool. They're saying like sometimes you have a pain somewhere and then when you deal with the issue, it disappears.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So tell us a little bit about PTSD. Are there any signs, symptoms that someone might have maybe a less obvious PTSD? Because I think we've all heard that you get bitten by a dog, now you're scared of dogs. That's pretty obvious. Or you avoid being around dogs. But other than avoidance and phobias, are there any other signs and symptoms that might be less obvious?
Yeah, well, I think it's important to distinguish that there's two different forms of PTSD too. There's acute PTSD, which is like soldiers coming back from war, the kid who got bit by the dog, bad accident, the one kind of incident of that. And then there's also complex PTSD, which is where that's more of like the childhood trauma, the childhood patterning that you picked up is going to give you those complex PTSD symptoms. So that might be things like codependency, addiction, numbing, perfectionism, attachment issues in your relationship, the body pains and tensing, probably some type of autoimmune you're going to see on there. So many different symptoms can come from that that you wouldn't necessarily think would be PTSD.
Yeah, I have a lot of people on talk about female hormonal imbalances. And they always mention, they're like, this is going to sound crazy, but it starts usually with like a childhood trauma or trauma around puberty.
Absolutely, because that's your core reproductive symptom, right? So that's so in that chakra, that sacral sense and energy of you is having a reaction to what you experienced. A lot of people who I see who come in with like sexual trauma have pain in their bodies, pain in their hips, and their psoas muscles. And so there's a lot of physical and somatic kind of relief that you can do to help facilitate that as well too, moving the trauma out of the body.
So are you into that stuff where it's like, if this hurts, it could be this, if that hurts, it could be this type of trauma?
Definitely. I don't know them all for sure, so I'm not going to pretend to, but there are different energetic points throughout the body. And of course, like through the acupuncture meridian point. So you'll see if you follow that path down, they will be connected for you in that way.
Yeah. Super cool.
Body is crazy cool.
I heard somebody told me once that they couldn't say something, like there was something that they didn't feel comfortable expressing. And then they got like cancers or something like that, like in the throat. And then once they just went through therapy and they let it out, it just disappeared. And the doctors don't know why. And I hear these little stories from people all the time. And it just sounds like it's a lot of people and nobody really pays attention to this conventionally.
I definitely agree with you. And I think that more medical doctors need to be thinking about trauma in their diagnosis as well, or at least giving a recommendation to follow that through, because there's people who are out there, hypochondriacs as well, like looking for the answers of what's wrong with them. And what's wrong with them is trauma. And that's a really difficult thing to say to some people, because they look at their childhood and they think, no, it was really good, or it's too painful, I don't want to look at it. But looking at the patterning is going to have a lot of medical diagnosis change as well. And that being said, I think it's important to still take care of your body and do what you can to with that as well. I had Crohn's disease, and technically, I guess I still have it, but I noticed that the more that I do the deep healing work and heal through my own traumas and experience, I've been in remission. And I think that's just so interesting that there's that connection there. And I really did have to leave behind for me the medical experience of that was too painful. So I chose to take care of it holistically. I didn't really think that healing my trauma would make it go away or disappear. And it didn't disappear necessarily, but it certainly healed.
Are there any specific types of trauma that tend to go with gut issues?
I think trauma and gut issues are really connected. So I wouldn't say that there's a specific one necessarily. A lot of like eating disordered type of behaviors, you'll see there'll be gut connection. Mother wounds can be a really deep gut connection, because that's that kind of survival instinct as well, being fed. But really any kind of trauma can show up in the gut. There's going to be a reaction there.
I remember one time I had a really horrible boss, and she was like, I'm gonna find something wrong with your charts and I'm gonna get you out of here. She was just an evil person, and I never had stress before. So I was just like, what's going on? I gained so much weight. I had super bloating, and I was always like very thin, but I was like super bloated, and I got reflux for the first time in my life. And finally my husband's like, quit. And then I just left, and eventually it got better. But it's just so quickly when somebody is stressing you out that your health can just completely deteriorate.
Absolutely. Stress creates a hormonal shift in your body. You're going to react to that. And also when I think about stressful experiences, your body kind of constricts this way, right? Like you tense in that pain. So you're just holding on to that more and more and letting it settle into your body.
So I was looking at depression rates and antidepressant rates on the CDC website, and it's really terrifying. So it says there's an uptick in depression and antidepressant use in women. As you get older, there's more chances of you being depressed and needing medication. This was before the pandemic.
Before the pandemic. I think there's just also more awareness about what these experiences are spreading. And so people are thinking about that. And also people are more stressed out. There's more responsibility on us. I imagine that's just when they're waking up to it, that depression probably they did experience in their childhood in one way or another too, or that's where it was really forming.
And what are your thoughts on medication for depression? Because I'm going to tell you personally, unless you have a severe mental illness, I don't like medication.
Yeah.
Because you can do so much with diet and therapy that medication just seems like a Band-Aid on a bullet hole.
It's definitely a Band-Aid on a bullet hole, but it does depend on how big that bullet hole is. So there are some people that, and sometimes I think where you need to use the medication to get to a more stable place. And then from there, I think you really can heal your depression through trauma talk therapy, somatic movement and different things, diet. And that works well for a lot of people who are ready to do the changes necessary and actually deal with their depression. But for some people, they're not ready to do that yet. And they might be feeling suicidal. They might be feeling so depressed that they can't get out of bed. It's good to take the medication and get to a place where you're like having a little bit more movement and stability again. But it's definitely not a long-term thing that you want to be doing, in my opinion.
Yeah, I see that because I have a lot of friends when they get depressed over something, I'm always like, what are you eating? How's your sleep? And more times than not, they're not sleeping. They're eating junk food, carbs, sugar. And instead of dealing with the problem, they just try to cover it up with junk food, sugars, sweets, candies, just by the TV. And then that can make the hormones off and that makes the sleep off. And it just goes from there.
Well, the core is that person is needing to process and stress something, right? So they're self-medicating with food in that moment and trying to care for their depression the best that they know how in that moment. But there are better ways. So as you're moving through that, it would be good to recognize that's what you're doing and deal with the connection to yourself. I think that's why people really struggle in general, is because there is such a difficulty with connecting with ourselves. People don't want to be present or look at their past experiences because it's painful. So you just find ways to soothe it and keep going. But then you don't get rid of that cycle. You just continue to move with that pattern.
Yeah. I remember when I was dealing with a stressful boss, I never ate garbage food in my life. I was such a healthy person, but I found myself at work ordering pizza delivery.
Yeah.
That's just like such a weird thing. And then of course I felt sick. Of course all of the health problems would happen after. It just makes sense. And then once I quit, I was able to stop doing that.
Yeah, body is a really good indicator of what's going on in your mind and that well-being as well. So noticing the signs that your body shows. I'm all about intuitive eating, but if ordering pizza at work is like not what you normally do, you want to check in with that and think, well, why am I doing that? Am I really just in the mood for pizza? Okay, fine. If not, exploring what's going on with that.
Yeah. Could you tell me a little bit about intuitive eating? Because this, I'm just like, I would never listen to my intuition, because if I did, it would just be whipped cream. this is what I really want. Right? Like if you ask me.
That's what you think because you live with that restricted mindset, right? Because you're not going to want whipped cream all the time. You only think you want whipped cream right now because it's a restricted kind of thing for you. So that's really what the core of intuitive eating is, allowing yourself and all foods to be okay and safe to you, obviously within your body's limit of digestion too, because we have different ways of that. But there's no good foods or bad foods, and just allowing yourself to eat with what feels good to your body and what makes your body feel good too. So that wouldn't be whipped cream because you're going to get that kind of sugar rush. It feels good in the moment and maybe you want a little bit of whipped cream at the end of the day. That's okay too.
Yeah. I know like my husband's lactose intolerant, but he loves cheese.
He loves cheese.
Yeah. It's just how it is. Maybe it's just that. So one thing that you can't have and you're just like, but I can't have it. And then you think about it too much.
Exactly. Yeah. You're like, that's the only thing you're thinking about.
Since you work with people with eating disorders, what are some tips maybe that you can give people to want to eat healthier and not take it too far?
I think make it not about your body. So really considering those non-scale victories as well. And for me, sustainability and being environmentally conscious is really important too. I just know that for my body, I like eating whole foods. And so that's what I tend to do and I think is the healthiest thing for the environment as well and for our bodies. So think about those other things, right? Think about how energetic you feel when you're eating well. You're not getting these different slumps and your skin gets better. That feels so good. So think about it in that way because you'll also find that your body comes to the place where it's meant to be in like that perfect adjustment when you're taking good care of it and eating good foods. It all just does what it needs to do, walking and whatever.
Yes. So for my hormonal imbalances, I can't have dairy and gluten.
Okay.
And of course, those are the best foods. in my mind and in the world. So what I do to trick myself to not do it so much, but not tell myself I can't have it, is I go, if you want it, make it from scratch.
Okay.
Don't buy anything that makes it easy. Every little ingredient has to be like organic or like from a pasture, farm, whatever, farm to table type style, and then make it from hand. Don't use any machines. So I will whip cream with a fork. It'll take me like an hour, but then I'm like, now you deserve it. Because if it's easy, I feel like then you're just going to mindlessly do it. Like you have to decide if it's really worth it.
I can understand that, but you deserve the whipped cream no matter what. You're eating it anyway at the end of the day. So it's healing that relationship to food as well, so that it doesn't feel like it has this big power over you.
Yeah.
It's hard to do. Break these kind of cycles that we've created. And that does come from the childhood trauma, childhood patterning. Food is one of the easiest things that we can control in our lives. And so that's why we also see it doesn't mean you have like severe eating disorders for you to have issues with food. We see it with so many people. It's issues with oral fixation and using that to kind of heal things. Yeah.
It's also that people are under stress and they just want something to do. It used to be smoking years ago. Now it's like snacking.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the literal same thing, right? It's just like a self-soothing technique, the kid who's putting the pacifier in their mouth to calm down. And that's hard because that does mean now like opening the door to exploring how this developed for you and being able to heal that, as well as all the limiting beliefs and conditioning that we receive about our body and food and diet and culture at the same time. So there's so many different layers to healing.
Have you noticed that after the pandemic, people got more eating issues?
100%. I am seeing like some 2000s era type of behavior coming out. And it's honestly a little bit scary for me. I even heard recently that Pro Anna websites are coming back again. Pro Anna TikToks are coming up. And I think that's really harmful and definitely a reaction to the trauma of the pandemic and the isolation.
I remember that growing up, I'm super old. I was on LiveJournal.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So I remember coming across, and I was always very thin naturally. I was very lucky, but I would make a comment or whatever. And then somebody from one of those titles in their names would like say something mean to me. Like, oh, you don't get to have like opinions because you're just naturally like this or whatever. And I just look them up and then look at what they're following and look at all this horrible content. And I'm just like, wow. And they were talking about, this is off topic, but they were talking about, oh, never have kids because they just make you fat. That's the last thing you want. And they would just show before kids and after kids pictures of celebrities like to get themselves horrible. To be like, we don't want children.
Yeah.
Very scary stuff.
We definitely want to fill our brain and our programming with positive messages about our body, and really body neutrality, I think, is going to be important to be focusing on too, because we are so much more than that. And healing ourselves and healing our soul is really going to allow us to fully find acceptance and love for ourselves and everybody else.
There was something else I wanted to ask you. You mentioned about like shamanic or something. What is that?
So shamanism is like this is a horrible way to explain it. I'm sorry if this comes off offensive, is going to be like the shaman type of godlike man of the village, and that still exists today. People who are really connected to their spiritual and psychic abilities and healing abilities. So you can see them for different type of energy work or spirit guidance.
Have you done that?
I have had experiences with shamans, yes.
And how does it go? What have you gotten?
So I worked through just healing some heaviness after my divorce, and we did a ritual spiritual bath. Can't even remember all the things he used, but like really pouring cold water over you. I think there was this like honey mixture, and just cleansing you and cleansing your energy and your soul. During that experience, I did see my ex, visions of my ex leaving me and my aura and his mom, who I had a lot of trauma with. So it was a really interesting experience that I had.
I think about the ritual aspect of, we used to have so many rituals, coming of age rituals, the marriage rituals of joining people, like rituals for all these things. And we don't have many of them anymore. So I'm wondering if maybe humans really need something like that.
I think that ritual and community is so important for us as human beings. And I do think we forgot that for a while, especially in America. Like, we live in this more individualistic society. And that's great to have the resilience and independence and all of that. But we also really need connection and each other. And that's where ritual comes in, right? Or even people who like go to church every week. It's for that community building and connection that we can have with each other. And it would be great to have that. And you can do that throughout your daily life as well, like creating little rituals for yourself, lighting candles, doing your journaling, taking a bath, sipping your coffee outside with writing, just being able to be more in connection.
When I was growing up, I noticed that there would be different family dynamics from my friends. And the ones where they had everything was like a party, everything was celebrated, they had a lot of get-togethers, and it was just so much more fun. And you'd see all the generations in the party. They could get away with, I swear, they could eat like garbage, they could never exercise, and they would just live forever. Oh, and it's just so crazy. And then you'd see the people who are like super healthy, but they're alone most of the time. And maybe they have more depressive episodes every now and then. Breakups are harder for them. And I just see there's definitely something to the community keeps you healthy.
Definitely. It really does. We're animals at the end of the day. And part of what makes us work as animals is that herd mentality, that community, like the villages that we used to live in and the tribes we used to live in, we've super separated from that. Everyone is like in their own little box. And when you're younger, like you have school and that type of a connection that sort of carries you through. But then there's this period of, what do you do? And especially for those people who aren't having children or are single, you really kind of lose that community aspect.
Yes. And that's something that I worry about, especially for a lot of my friends are like, I don't want kids. I don't want a family. I'm like, well, come on, at least make a really good friend group of other people who are single. But you need to create something.
Sure. Yeah. Having people around you is going to be a good thing, no matter how that is formed.
So tell us how everyone can work with you. And do you see patients virtually as well?
I do see patients virtually, and I operate as a therapist in California. So if people are in California, they can work with me for therapy. And I also have my coaching business and program, which I'm able to see people all over virtually. And they can find me at Talk with Rocks on Instagram. There's a lot of my links in there so that you can follow that through and see the different ways to work with me. I also have a Heal Your Inner Child course that people can do independently, like work through different modules around that and do the subconscious reprogramming as well through our hypnotic meditations and journaling. So it's a really cool thing they can check out also on the links in my bio.
Awesome. So is there anything else you'd like to leave the audience with before we go?
Yeah, I think the one thing that I would really like to say is that we all have different impacts of our childhood patterning, and that's okay. That doesn't mean we're angry or should be more in that shame. It's just good to explore how the patterning is showing up for us, because a lot of times that is in the mental health symptoms, in the chronic autoimmune symptoms, and you can find healing by exploring how you came to be.
Awesome. So I'm going to put all your information in the show notes. And thank you again for being with us.
Thank you, Kat.
I had an episode a while back with Dr. Mona Fahoum of Feminescence, and we spoke about Feminescence, Maca Harmony, and their Maca products. And if you're a woman who's ever had hormonal imbalances, if you're trying to come off the birth control pill, or even if you're going through menopause, this is a natural way to help ease that transition and to help balance your hormones. There's nothing quite like it. So go to feminescence.com, enter code KAT15, KAT15, for 15% off any of their single pack products. And definitely go check out the episode. Just search for Mona Fahoum on my podcast and listen. You won't regret it. Thank you for listening to the episode. If you made it this far, I'm sure you found some benefit to the hard work that I put into the show. Show your support by subscribing to the podcast, leave me a voicemail question, or email me at thehealthfulgypsy@gmail.com. I would love, love, love to hear from you. Be sure to join the Facebook group. You can find all that information in the show notes and my website, katkatibi.com. This podcast is for informational merrymakings and metaphysical purposes only. Statements and views are not medical advice. This podcast, including CACA-TB, disclaim any adverse effects by the use of information you may have heard. Opinions of guests are totally their own. This podcast does not endorse statements made by guests. This podcast does not make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications, credibilities, or sanity. Individuals may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to on the podcast. If you think you have a medical problem, consult with a licensed medical physician, not just the spirit of your ancestors while on ayahuasca.